Hello and welcome to Digital Careers, which offers insights and advice on advancing your digital career, as well as making your digital hiring more effective. Now, my guest this week is Brian Pearson, who is Toronto, Canada-based and requires very little introduction within the loyalty industry. Brian was most recently the global CEO and president of Loyalty One, a pioneer in loyalty strategies and measured marketing and part of US-listed Alliance Data. Apart from Brian's impressive commercial exploits, he's also an author, having published The Loyalty Leap, Turning Customer Information into Customer Intimacy. He's also a keynote speaker at high-profile loyalty conferences globally, and a contributor to a number of publications, including Forbes.com. And today, our subject is retail loyalty on the line now as never before. So I hope you enjoy the show. Brian, thank you for being involved and welcome to Digital Careers Podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure, Guy. Topic of conversation I love, so.
Great. Well, we're going to get on to your career in just a moment, but let's just introduce the show, because we're going to be talking about retail loyalty on the line now as never before. And part of the reason I came up with this topic was that there's been a lot of digital transformation over the last 12 months, of course. And one statistic that I read possibly in one of the articles of yours that you've written is that 70% of consumers have now tried new shopping behaviors over the last 12 months, which might mean new brands, new websites, new retailers that they've trialed. And that means that loyalty probably has become more integral to retailers than ever before. So we're going to really explore that topic, and there's a number of themes that we're going to go down. But before we launch into all that exciting stuff, a little bit about you, a couple of minutes about what you're up to in the loyalty space and how you got into loyalty and obviously your role at Loyalty One.
It's always fun to think about where you start that conversation. You know, I stumbled into loyalty because I was a frustrated marketer, if you want, and maybe a non-doctor. So my undergraduate degree is in biochemistry and life sciences. I went on to do an MBA. And then when I got into what I thought was going to be the career of choice, which was sort of being a brand marketer, I discovered that I was really struggling with my scientific background. From there, I moved to direct marketing and eventually to loyalty marketing, an industry that I've been in for 30 years now. And I loved it. I landed there at Loyalty One. We launched the Air Miles program, which people in the UK would be familiar with from back in the time tunnel, and was involved with all sorts of various industries trying to figure out how to make loyalty work, but also how to maximize its potential to create, acquisition in a coalition environment, but also to retain and lift consumer spend and engage with them more wholesomely. Halfway through my career, I started to get frustrated with that what was happening in that space, because I just really came upon this view that, the magic of loyalty and understanding your consumer is building an element of relevance around how you communicate with them and entice them to experience your services or your retail environment in a different way. Wrote a book called The Loyalty Leap, which I think still is relevant today. It was published in 2012. Was CEO of Loyalty One for the last 13 years. And during that time period, expanded from being just a loyalty program provider to also do retail analytics and ultimately get into tactical loyalty with the acquisition we made of Brand Loyalty in the Netherlands. And that exposed me to such a breadth of data, the analytic potential, how loyalty fits in that environment. And really at the end of the day, the most important thing, which is how do you really enrich the experience for the consumer? So today, retired from Loyalty One, spent the last 18 months, a combination of traveling and now stuck at home like everybody else. Working, advising companies in and around the loyalty space, in and around the customer engagement space, and still staying really quite current on everything that's going on. Exciting times.
And you're doing writing and thought leadership type stuff out there, aren't you? I mean, you're a regular contributor to Forbes, amongst others, is that right?
Yeah, write for Forbes.com. And then we republish that through a number of loyalty-related publications. But that keeps your hand fresh, right? It keeps you tuning into what's happening in the marketplace and how different retailers are thinking about loyalty. And I spend a lot of time actually catching up with old colleagues. And one thing when you've been around the industry for 30 years is the people that have come into your business now are running some of the most interesting loyalty initiatives, certainly in Canada and North America and even globally. So it really keeps your hand in the game.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And retail, obviously, over the last 12 months has had a lot of headlines, particularly in the grocery retail space, obviously, with the boom in online shopping. I guess the biggest question that's on everyone's minds is, how ingrained is consumer buying behavior as a result of the last 12 months? If we scroll ahead, what do you think is hardwired, and what do you think the future of consumer buying behavior is going to look like on the back of the last 12 months?
I think this has been a wonderful opportunity for retailers to up their game in certain things that they've had to focus on, whether that's opening new channels of distribution or engagement with the customer, improving their digital experience, or even, you know, waking up and recognizing what they have in their loyalty asset and how important that might be. I think that the change is relatively permanent, put it that way. Well, I don't think we'll stay at the levels that we have been. I think you're starting to see the retail community start to talk about pullback, especially in grocery and food retail. But new retail channels, new digital experiences, and I'd say new demographics that are being engaged in a digital experience, all those things are going to hit a high watermark, will probably recede a little bit, but I don't think it's going to come back that far.
And what about considerations for loyalty in this new world then? If you were to kind of almost get a checklist of advice for people contemplating approach to loyalty, consumer loyalty, what are the things that you'd have on your sort of top three or four on the checklist?
I think what happened through the pandemic, and I think it's good for the loyalty industry as a whole and just the execution of loyalty as a practice. The first thing is that suddenly everybody decided they needed to go direct to consumer and start this dialogue with the consumers. And I think a lot of them went to the cupboards behind me. They opened the cupboards and surprise, there was nothing there. They, you know, they had not paid attention to their data files and the hygiene. They had not really, you know, fostered the right environment to create those, you know, quote unquote relationships with their customers. And when you open the cupboards and it's bare, you all of a sudden realize, oh my God, there's this asset that is very important and I don't really have it in a state that it needs to be. So I do believe that we're going to see, you know, this cupboard is bare syndrome is going to result in a renewed investment from companies that have loyalty initiatives to recognize the importance of knowing who their customers are, having a robust, you know, dialogue, let's say, with them, and making the appropriate investments to ensure that their loyalty platform, you know, will fulfill, if, you know, God help us, the pandemic version 2.0 sort of shows up. I think the other thing is that what we've seen is digital used to be a critical differentiator. I think a lot of loyalty programs out there were using digital and that experience as a means to really look again across the aisle at the competition and say, no, we're much better because look at this digital platform and this digital experience and this app that we have. The last 12 months have just leveled the playing field on that front. Everybody's had to up their game in the digital experience. And so when you look at that, you're creating a greater level playing field. And that leads to a need, I believe, again, for companies to really assess what's the value proposition that I'm offering. Now, how strong is the mechanic that I have? How good is the engagement that I have with my customer? And I think all those things, again, will lead down the road to loyalty playing a larger role in the marketing mix for companies.
So what you're talking about there is that whole end-to-end experience of the consumer. And we'll dig into some of those components in a second. But when you think about, I mean, a lot of what you've had exposure to is loyalty from industries outside of retail. You obviously had a lot of exposure to retail as well, as you highlighted earlier. What do you like in the way of loyalty mechanisms out there for retailers? What do you think has worked well? What's impressed you from a proposition point of view, either through, you know, the brand or even the digital technology that sits behind it, for example?
I often get asked, you know, what's the best expression of loyalty? Who's doing it really, really well? And it's such an interesting question because I'm a Frankenstein fan when it comes to programs. I like a little of this, and I think this person's doing this piece really well. And wow, this digital experience is super. And look at the mechanism over here and how they've actually twisted this on its side. So to hold up a shining light and say, you know, Amazon is the proverbial best loyalty program that's out there, it's very difficult for me to do. I think the second thing, which is really kind of interesting in loyalty, we used to call it the ultimate stealth bomber, right? It's this view that what you see on the surface, the what is being, you know, the baseline offering that a company puts out around its loyalty initiative, and I'll get to the mechanisms in a second, but that's sort of the vanilla. It's what the bare necessities you need to engage Guy to sort of sign up and start to engage. And the issue is that the real magic that happens is when you take the insights and the customer information, you sort of meld it together, and then it's the one-to-one personalized experience that the really good providers are doing, which runs under cover of darkness. You know, as a competitor, unless you're actually a very loyal customer for your competing brand, you don't see what's happening and what offers are coming out. And so, you know, we always used to call it the ultimate stealth marketing tool, because if you did it right, your competitors couldn't figure out what you were doing to incent and sort of drive the behavior where you're making investments. So I think that's kind of the magical piece of it. And then, yeah, I think you talked about mechanic, and I'd say, what do I look for, right? What do I look for? I look for the value. What is the reward? What is the relationship that's being built around recognition and maybe even connection and community? You know, how does that actually come to play? The second thing is really the experience. So, and in that world, for me, it's about relevance. It's ultimately about, I'm sharing information with you now. How are you going to use that information to craft something that comes back and is creating a more relevant experience that reflects who I am and how I engage with your brand? Thirdly, would be the actual mechanism, which is, I think, where you started this. These days, it's got to be easy. It's got to be omnichannel. But I think there's some creativity that's happening in how people are dealing with payments, for example, as a means to actually create a deeper engagement and a deeper connection with the consumer. And then the last thing that I like to look for in loyalty is really the mindset. And that is, when you look at a program and I look at the staff and the way the company is embracing it, are they truly moving with a customer first kind of approach? Or is this a means to kind of offset other expenditures or expenses and find a way to kind of economically make things work better for them? You know, if you have a real true consumer first mindset, you make investments behind the loyalty initiative and your most loyal customers, which are differential.
Yeah. So one of the themes that taken out of that is deep personalization.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other one is the sense of community and advocacy. I think some of the things that's really interesting that is happening in loyalty is just the way that they're engaging around issues. So I'll give you two examples. One Canadian brand, but international, Lululemon, sort of athleisure wear.
Well. Yeah.
Rolling out a loyalty program. I had an opportunity to sit down with the head of loyalty out there, and, you know, very interesting to hear. They're not putting out this sort of vanilla program. It's subscription-based. You pay over $100 to join it. You get free clothing every year for the $100, but they will not go into a market with a loyalty program unless they build the infrastructure around the store. And that's been very true to Lululemon as a brand. You know, they used to have yoga classes in store, and there was all this wellness stuff that happened. And so, you know, their loyalty program is a great expression of what they're trying to do in the brand experience overall, but it's hyper-local, and it connects with the localized brands, and it fosters community and advocacy, which I think is very interesting. Maybe a little tougher for a Sainsbury's to do that at scale, but, you know, that kind of an idea. I think another one is tactical short-term loyalty program, which historically has been collect stamps, redeem for merchandise or goods. And I think that world is evolving. It's going to change dramatically. And the reason why is retailers have always talked about in-store theater and sort of how do you connect consumer issues with their brands and sort of tell richer stories. And I think these programs have an opportunity to really evolve in a completely different way to help the retailer really connect with consumers around a loyalty initiative, but also telling a powerful story that is about how they're supporting the consumer, supporting community, supporting sustainability, whatever it may be. So I think there's richness that is going to come out of that.
And on that tactical loyalty thing, I mean, that's obviously focused on grocery in a large sense. But one of the things in the grocery space that I'm reading about, there was this quote from the UK CEO of Lidl, the German discount retailer. And the quote went something along the lines of, the UK online total share has gone from about 7% to 14%. We reckon it's going to come back and sit at around 10. We're quite happy focusing on the 90%. I mean, that was the theme of the quote. What's your read on where you think online versus online is going to naturally sit in the grocery space moving forwards? Because, I mean, you talked about differentiation and that there's a leveling of the playing field in terms of digital technology and so forth. But what do you think this online-offline conundrum is? Where's it going to even out, in your view?
it's such an interesting question because a lot of retailers were dragged kicking and screaming into this, especially in the North American marketplace. And I think that, you know, if you looked at the most developed retailers, the most developed markets, the online or buy online, pick up in store, or curbside, you know, alternative to the formats, to the consumer coming in and picking and driving their food, their groceries home, you know, is maybe 25 to 30% share, right? And so all of a sudden now, you see that rise with new entrants, more participation, new demographic segments who are using this out of need. I think, first of all, a lot of the markets are going to come up into the 20s where they were basically sub 5%, and that's here to stay. And then the question is, how much further will they go? And I think there's this interesting push-pull situation in this right now. The pull part is the consumer who will say, you know, I kind of like this. I might not do it all the time, but for the larger items or for stock up shops or things like this, why not have somebody come and deliver groceries and I won't have to actually get to the store and lug this stuff around? And the push part is the retailer, I think, will push back a little. And the reason for that is economically, I mean, what you've seen is sales go up dramatically, but the profit margins in the food retail industry have not moved proportionately. Yeah. And the reason for that is the entire industry was premised on the idea that I stock the shelves, you come in and pick the groceries, and you drive them home. All of a sudden now, I have to do the picking, and I have to figure out delivery, and I have to do it economically, or you won't necessarily, you know, continue to shop at my location if that becomes another lever to compete for the consumer's dollar. And so for me, I think until the retail community sees the economics start to right size and we understand the kind of standard non-pandemic dynamic of how much is a consumer willing to pay or what's the nature of the shops that will be done this way versus another way, I don't think we've seen the full economic picture fall out.
Yeah.
And that will drive how much the retailer will push greater adoption beyond sort of having to have these services available so that, guess what? You know, I've got a shot at least getting the consumer to come in and shop because I'm meeting them on their terms.
And I guess it also depends on the geography in the world. I mean, if you look at somewhere like China, which has gone a whole lot further down the road in terms of its adoption of e-commerce and online shopping and grocery, it's a different comparison to somewhere in, you know, Eastern Europe, for example. So it just depends on where you are in the world. In terms of adding some context, I mean, that fulfillment piece you talked about, getting home delivery and even curbside pickup, we call it click and collect over here, just to be different. But yeah, I mean, making that profitable is a tough conundrum for the retailers. I think Tesco started pre-pandemic at fulfilling about 500,000 orders a week to home delivery. That spiked beyond 1.5 million. So it's gone up enormously. And I suspect, you know, they'll have the answers, I'm sure, but suppliers come into the party in some way to soften that blow and make it financially viable, I'm sure, is part of the equation. You touched on some of the demographic things as well around loyalty and the future of retail. I mean, one of the things I read in one of your articles is quite interesting. It was talking about how the pandemic has impacted younger generations, and they are the consumers, the shoppers of tomorrow. How do you see that playing out and the influence of the parental influence, I suppose, on those individuals and how that might shape their future buying habits?
I think the younger generation to begin with is more digital savvy and has a different expectation. I mean, it's interesting to see even in my household with the range that I have an almost 30-year-old and a closer to 20-year-old. And even in that decade, the social media usage, the way they shop, they're dramatically different as individuals. And so I think the demographics at either extreme are effectively the greatest change. Older demographics, it's pushed them to do more online shopping and to recognize and sort of have that experience and sort of go, well, I could actually do more of this. And my lovely spouse is a great example of that. Not really a big adopter of online shopping, but has moved dramatically, even as stores opened up here, to continue to use those services. And then I think of the younger demographic, the adoption and the change rates and the way that they look at technology and the way they look at how that's impacted their lives over the last 12 months. You know, what's the long-term impact of that? I think there's a very near-term impact, which is they're watching the world kind of move by and trying to figure out how to support that network or that view. I think on the long-term side of things, you know, my crystal ball just isn't really that clear. I mean, it's so much change in technology, so much change in format, so much change in how the socio impact of those things fall out. I don't know, honestly.
A couple of other trends that perhaps you've seen emerging. I mean, you touched on payments earlier on, so let's perhaps explore some of the technology sitting behind loyalty. Payments is one, health and fitness is another. And, I think that ties into some of the things you described about creating theatre in store to, reinforce the message of healthy eating that the retailer might be looking to try and convey. The whole data piece you've touched on to create greater personalization. But what are the tech sitting behind the scenes in loyalty programs? What excites you and what trends do you see as really playing a part in future loyalty programs?
Boy, where do you start with that? Let's start with data and personalization because you raised it earlier. I think that continues to be a super important part of the entire equation. What I see there is artificial intelligence, machine learning, essentially coming in and starting to do a bit more of the heavy lifting. And that opens up the opportunity for the loyalty practitioner, the data scientist to be less on the I'm running the analytics and doing the algorithms and more on the interpretation of what they're seeing coming out. And so I think there'll be a richness in how programs and offers and the movement of dollars that are being expended, spent by the retailer in where they invest it. I think we'll see changes in that. And I'm looking forward to seeing how that evolves because I know there's a lot of waste. It's that old adage, right? I know 50% of my marketing dollars are wasted. I just can't figure out which half, There's lots of people struggling with attribution in the digital environment. It's all getting better, but I think that really will bring value. There's a lot of talk about virtual reality and augmented reality and those things. And, despite Oculus and all these sorts of things coming along, I still think that's a long play. I don't see that being absolutely critical. Are we going to go in and pick stores in virtual reality? Maybe one day, but I think that technology has another couple of cycles to go before we're there. The digital experience and mobile applications, absolutely. I mean, I think, the magic that sits on our phone and the ability of that device to be as transformative as it's been, I just see that continuing to accelerate, whether that's our own scanning, using it to scan our own groceries while we're in store, as long as you can figure out the weight thing, all the way through to the messaging and the interaction I have and the personalization effect. Payments, two parts to that. I think one is blockchain. There was a whole movement at one point about creating blockchain-enabled loyalty programs, and I think that's taking a sledgehammer to drive in a one-inch nail. I just I'm struggling to understand why we're going to overheat the planet with computer energy in order to do something that can be tracked and has proven to be pretty effective before. Maybe in payments, there's a greater part to play. But again, I put it in the VR, AR world where I can see an application. I'm not sure economically there's a ton that makes sense. And then I think the last one, I think you raised payment vehicles and payments just in general. And I think there's going to be an interesting coming together because we've already seen the interchange rates come down years ago in the UK and in Australia and other markets like North America. There's still very high interchange rates. But as we see that, I think compress, which is naturally going to happen between competitors and government regulation, payment and loyalty will become much more intrinsically linked. And as a mechanic, as a system, as an experiential element, I think we'll see payments evolve quite dramatically in the next little while to compete with the low price entrants that are coming in. I think you said health and wellness guy. And I just think generally, from a loyalty standpoint, you ignore health, wellness, sustainability at your peril. So consumers today are looking for, and this might get back to the kids question you asked before in the pandemic, which is their sensitivity to all these sorts of things, their conversations about mental health, all those sorts of components are much richer than we would have had. And they're genuinely, the amount of communication bombarding them. I mean, my kids are asking the question of, do I bring children into the world because global warming is going to make the planet a complete desert? And you're sort of like, wow, I don't remember having that conversation when I was in my 20s, right? And so I think today's youth is certainly, as they evolve, they're going to ask more of companies as they evolve to be the major consuming class. And you just ignore those things at your peril.
Yeah. Okay. Those are some of the sort of the more commercial aspects of loyalty and retail. I want to move on to, after all, this show is called Digital Careers. So we should probably talk about careers at some point. You've hired a lot of great loyalty folks over the years in different parts of the world. What do you think in today's retail loyalty world, what's the mindset and the leadership qualities that you would be looking for in hires out there?
I mean, we used to always talk about the fact that there was an the art and science of loyalty. Yeah. And the art was really this view of taking consumer insights and really, and creativity and sort of being able to see, you know, the forest for the trees in the essence of, you know, what was really happening, what really would engage the consumers, what really are the challenges that they're facing. And so I think that's the art part. And then the science part is you can't get away from the fact that loyalty programs, digital marketing in general, creates this data exhaust on customers that allows you to have a much richer view on the measurement and the analytics that you can apply against them, which allow you to be much more effective, efficient, et cetera, in what you do. And so when I look for talent, I looked for that ability for people to engage on both sides, to be able to put those, especially at more senior levels, to put those things together. And the thing that I love, that I really, really passionately strove for in, and probably was the indicator, greatest indicator of success, was intellectual curiosity. Hmm. You know, they didn't stop at, well, this is what it said, and so here's an outcome. They would dig and explore and sort of pull at it until they really got to something interesting. And so in the leadership side of things, I'd certainly look at that. So appreciation for strategy, appreciation for psychology, appreciation for technology, for math, how those things come together. I mean, in my mind, that's marketing. It doesn't matter. That was marketing whatever number of years ago. It's just we didn't have the tools that we have today.
If you kind of rewind and think about some of the most poignant moments of people that have worked for you and the challenges they've had and the advice you've given, what do you reflect on and what would you offer up as career advice for people listening into this?
Again, the folks who excelled quite often, I put them into very uncomfortable positions and things that they had no nascent sort of reason to be there, but they had that intellectual curiosity. And the feeling I had was, in order to be a great practitioner, you kind of had to round out your experience. And so in my view, the biggest success stories I had were those people that we did a very managed approach to moving them around to different areas of the business so that they had that kind of 360 view of what it took to run and operate and optimize a loyalty program in general. In fact, when people came in, even if they came in as business grads and they wanted to be in marketing or finance, we often started them as a business analyst, which was actually working with the database. Now, it's a little more complex these days, but the appreciation that they obtained by understanding what was there from a data standpoint, what could be done with the data, you know, what was reasonable and not reasonable, and then solving for some of the critical issues that our client companies had, I think it set them up to really have that rooting and understanding of what's there. Today, I'd say digital is a must. You have to do a tour of duty somewhere on the digital side. I think the second piece is analytics. You know, it remains a hotspot. It's a hiring. It's an area that people are always hiring for, is analytics related to loyalty programs and to the opportunities that are from there. And I think that when I look at that, those are certainly two of the pieces that you need to kind of screw together. Where you go, where you get that experience.
And I think the international piece as well. I mean, you've got a, although you've been probably based in Canada for the majority of your career, you've had a very international outlook, haven't you, over your career, particularly.
It's not to disparage my Forbes writing post, but you know, it's one of the things that I probably find the most frustrating about the North American mindset, which is it focuses very much on what's happening in North America. And Forbes always wants us to write about the business environment and community in North America. So I have to always make a link when I see something that I want to write about internationally, I have to link it back to what's happening in America. Yeah. But you're right on. I mean, the market, the development, there's a lot of consistency, and yet there are very interesting evolutionary differences when you look at how, even in Europe, Germany responds to loyalty versus what's happening in the UK. You know, very different loyalty markets, very different approach, because economically, the way they approach, you know, consumers approach the market is different culturally in both those markets. You wouldn't think it, but it is. And you raised the question of Asia, which is in China in particular. I mean, I've seen just the most fascinating executions of retail in and around China. And it's things that you really struggle to stand up in North America, but or in Europe. But at the end of the day, there's critical learnings that exist in that. So you have to keep your perspective very open.
Yeah, precisely. Well, look, it sounds like the loyalty world's a very exciting one, particularly in retail, for the next good few years. And people are going to have their work cut out in terms of predicting their future. I'm going to finish on just a bit of a fun question more than anything else, because I'm interested to know what book you've read recently, which can't be your own, Brian. It can be my favorite, but it can't be yours. In terms of consumer behavior and thought leader and this idea of getting the crystal ball out and trying to make some sense of the future and what it might hold, who impresses you out there? What books sort of, you know, resonated with you that you've read over the last year or so?
You know, I read it and I've met this individual and I had him speak at a conference into our company 10 years ago.
Right.
Because the book was published in 2009. And in the advisory work I'm doing now, as I'm dealing with CEOs and chatting with management teams that are working through strategy issues and connecting with the consumer and, you know, base marketing, I have brought this metaphor or his approach up more often than not. And that's Simon Sinek. And it's Start With Why book, his first book. And I literally took it off the shelf about 4 months ago and I read it again. Mm. And I just went, there's so much richness and it's so elegant and simple. And I think that there's just too many organizations that get stuck on the product and what they're doing and not thinking about the underlying driver and purpose, mantra, whatever, that sort of drives the organization. And so for people in leadership roles or, you know, frankly, I think I always said everybody's selling. It doesn't matter if you're the marketer or you're the HR person. You've got to be part salesperson and you've got to be part visionary and you've got to be part being able to tell a powerful story and to explain and coalesce and bring people together to drive forward to something. And I think, you know, it just provides a very elegant way to shift your thinking and really get to a point where you've got an interesting story to tell.
Well, I completely agree. I mean, number one, he's a charismatic guy. He's a great storyteller. He keeps it simple. And I think it resonates with me as well, that book, because that point we were chatting about with younger generations, increasingly individuals are looking for purpose-driven companies. And, you know, it ties very much into the themes that he talks about. I follow him on Twitter and LinkedIn, along with the many other millions alongside me. Yeah, his little YouTube clips and the likes, they're very powerful.
Yeah. He's wonderful. The other one that I follow, just because I think he's got a very edgy and sort of pithy view of the world, is Scott Galloway. And he's written a number of books. I have not crawled into his books, but I do subscribe to his feed. And he's often a very contrarian commentator on Amazon and Google and Apple. And there's a little bit of a socialist twist in how he looks at the world. I don't know if you followed Scott, but I have found myself flipping a few of his blog posts over to various individuals over the last few months, just because, you know, they're thought provoking. I don't know if they're always right, but, you know, it's just that different perspective and lens on something.
I think that's also the thing, isn't it? To be provocative and not just be a me too. And I think everyone can jump on those bandwagons. And I think that's the content that really stands out on the LinkedIns and the Twitters and that will capture people's interests. And some of the stuff that you're writing for Forbes, whilst it might have a North American centricity to it, there's always a thread back to whatever other market you might be into in the retail space. I mean, some of those trends are quite interesting because they might be ahead of other markets and, you know, North America might be slightly behind in others.
Yeah. I used to love the fact that in the coalition space with the Air Miles program, you know, we're dealing with the bank and then we're dealing with petrol and we're dealing with food retail and specialty retail of different kinds. And everybody would always go, well, why are you showing me a grocery example? I'm a bank, like, which is a completely different industry. Yeah. But the behavioral psychology and the way the consumer approaches how they're thinking about things, you know what? That's consistent. Yes, there are some cultural norms and differences as you move around the world, but there's some underlying things going back to Maslow's hierarchy, which are consistent because it's embedded in our DNA and how we operate as human beings. You know, the other thing is, I always love it when a retailer says, well, why would I look at the airline industry for how to run loyalty? Well, probably because they've had to do the most in terms of segmentation and recognizing their loyal customers and figuring out how to make that experience differentiated.
Yeah.
The consumer isn't looking at you, you know, Mr. Tesco, and saying, well, you're a food retailer and I'm comparing your experience to Sainsbury's and whatever else. Yes, I do that. But I also look at what you're doing relative to my experience on BA or relative to my experience on, you know, Air Canada. Mm. And there's this thing I call transference, which is, you know what, if they can do it, why can't you do it? And I don't care that that's an airline and you're a grocery store. they've cracked the code on what that experience needs to be. And I want you to reflect that, so I have a similar experience or I will get frustrated. And so, you know, there's a richness in those comparisons and the ability to connect the dots that way.
Lessons to be learned from different industries from a loyalty point of view. Well, listen, very interesting conversation. Could continue to talk for a lot longer, but we run out of time. Brian, thank you very much for joining me today. Really appreciate it. And all the best with your writing, thought leadership, conference speaking, advisory work over the course of the next year or so. Let's see if some of our predictions come true over the next 1 to 2 years post-COVID.
Yeah, let's compare notes and see how we did. That'd be great.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for joining me. Okay.
Cheers, my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed the discussion. The last 12 months have thrown up challenges and big opportunities in retail. And as we get past the pandemic, it will be really interesting to see how retail loyalty will be used as a mechanism for differentiation in an increasingly competitive omnichannel marketplace. And Brian's certainly got a wealth of loyalty experience to draw on, and I'd strongly encourage you to follow him on LinkedIn or Twitter, where he regularly publishes loyalty and retail thought leadership. Now, if you like what you hear on Digital Careers, remember to give it a 5-star rating. And if you need advice around your digital career or indeed support with your digital hiring, do get in touch with me at guy@bartonrock.com or visit my website, bartonrock.com.